This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Cymbeline is unanimously considered Shakespeare's most difficult play to stage. It might be because it's incredibly hard to follow on the page, even with color-coded flowcharts. The play includes a military battle, a decapitated corpse, poison, mistaken identity, the appearance of a Roman god, and a Scooby-Doo ending with no fewer than 17 revelations in a row. The Fiasco Theater of New York fearlessly staged Cymbeline to rave reviews, and you can see it at Duke Performances tonight and tomorrow. Jesse Austrian, Noah Brody, Ben Steinfeld are here. They're co-directors and co-artistic directors and founders of Fiasco, and they have joined us in the studio. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Nice to be here.
Cymbeline, what were you thinking?
Well, with that lead-in, I really have to wonder. It's a play that has lots of events. It's got great roles, great parts that actors love to play, and huge challenges, huge physical challenges, huge storytelling challenges, musical challenges. Those are all things that actors love to do. So it was very inviting for us.
Do you want to give a plot summary? Do you have a kind of a pat way of telling us what roughly this story is about, because there's a lot of twists and turns.
Well, it's hard to encompass the whole plot, but like a lot of Shakespeare plays, it kind of begins with a central crisis, a sort of central problem, and the central problem of King Cymbeline's court is one of succession, because 20 years ago his two sons were kidnapped, and so his daughter Imogen, who's the sort of center of the story, is the new heir. And she's fallen in love with Posthumus, who is not of royal blood. And so the king has decided that this relationship can't stand, and so he banishes Posthumus. And that's kind of the beginning crisis that the play follows. And so we sort of follow Posthumus and Imogen as they try to sort of find their way back to each other, and all the people who are related to the court and all of their desires for power and stuff like that.
Lots and lots of mistaken identity, a lot of deception, people who think they know what they're doing, poisons that are not poisons, that are passed off as medicines, given to the wrong person, all kinds of sleight of hand that happens. This is the thing that gives the play a reputation for being difficult. But in fact, Shakespeare makes an effort to make sure the audience follows every single bit of it. In fact, the audience is the only omniscient character in the play, in a sense. True?
That's a great way of thinking about it, actually. Yeah, I think that is true. You're 100% right. The audience follows what's happening because they are able to keep all of those things in balance. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this is these aren't just things that are fun or plot devices or sort of opportunities for the audience to be in on the gag. They're really questions about how we live. You know, Shakespeare's really using this kind of cascading series of mistakes and illusions as a way of sort of looking at how we process our own lives and the things that are in front of us and how limited our own ability to see and hear and perceive is sometimes.
Yeah, perception seems to be such an important part of this. I can think of there's a funeral scene. Two young men who don't even know who they are. They don't know they're the sons of kings, are about to give a funeral oration for a young man who they don't know is a woman, who they don't know if it had been a woman, if they had known that, they don't know that would have been their sister.
Right.
And they don't know she's not dead.
Right.
But the audience, we know all of this. We know all of the things that have gone on and why they're so mistaken. And yet that dirge that they sing is powerful. And we as an audience, even knowing that she's alive, can't help but feel for them. And I think, that's such a big part of it, that even if we're fooled, we can't help but emote and connect with the people who deeply feel what's mistakenly going on.
Absolutely. It's what Shakespeare does so brilliantly in this play, finding those moments of deep pathos even amidst the absurdity. And even though, as you said, we know what's going on. And something we discovered working on the play is this thematic idea that we can never know where we are in our own story, in your own life journey. And so though the audience can see what's going on, each character doesn't know where they are in their own arc. And when they think they're at rock bottom, it actually turns out that the thing that was tragic was required for the ultimate resolution of the play.
And some things that are tragic are at the same time comic. Imogen wakes up. She finds the decapitated body of the man she assumes is her husband,
right.
Which would be a horrible scene for any of us. We can't help but feel for her, even though we know it's not really her husband and it's a guy we don't much care about. But here's it's funny because she actually makes a point of going from toe to head, right, or from toe to neck. We would assume that at some point along the way she'd have found out that's not her husband, if you know what I mean. The audience had the same reaction, I'm guessing. He puts this in for comic effect.
Yep.
And so at the same moment, Shakespeare's thrown us around like a rag doll.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that Shakespeare understands both about the human condition and about storytelling, is that the fact that the audience knows all of these things, as you said, and the fact that Shakespeare has put together a story that to some degree contains a series of seemingly two-dimensional or archetypical characters isn't a problem to be solved. The audience actually appreciates it deeply. And because they have this information, they can experience both high comedy and deep tragedy sort of almost simultaneously, or at least directly next to each other. And Shakespeare just understands that that works. It isn't a problem. And I think sometimes we, or at least in theater, approach those things as problems to be solved somehow, as opposed to an idea to be embraced, that this is really the way life works. We experience high highs and low lows right next to each other.
Yeah, that's right. We talk about this a lot when we're teaching acting and when we're thinking about acting too, which is that once you open the channel of yourself, you have no idea what's going to happen, you know, but that's why we laugh when we're sad and cry when, you know, at weddings and stuff. I mean, you know, it's impossible to predict our own individual internal reactions to things. And I think, again, as Noah said, the play is really working on that level.
That said, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think also in that moment with the headless body and in several moments in the play, Shakespeare is purposely making a point about how quickly we believe things.
Yeah.
Whether we've investigated them or not, how easily we can believe that someone has betrayed us, that things are what they seem to be, even though they're not.
So this openness that you talk to, which is, I think, it appears to be what Shakespeare was after and what any good production will result in, it does seem that it would present challenges to stage this. What are some of the biggest challenges?
Well, as we've talked about, there's some crazy things that happen. We've made those challenges a little more challenging in some ways by only having six actors and essentially a blank stage. So what we decided was, if we can invite the audience to meet us, or maybe even more than halfway imaginatively, then we can actually buy ourselves a lot of artistic freedom and buy the story a lot of sort of stretch if we can suggest these things through music, through physicality, through actors, through a very kind of rough magic, as one of our old producers used to call it, that we use to make these things happen rather than trying to represent them literally. So when we give up trying to represent them literally, then their literal absurdity becomes less challenging, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the other thing is that the play can be done with, you know, 25 actors representing every aspect of, you know, from a Roman army to a royal court. Using only six actors, we're actually also investing in this whole idea of things aren't necessarily what they seem, an idea of mistaken identity. It presents both a challenge and also gives us a kind of way of dealing with those reversals, those challenges, those the necessity of representing a lot of different characters. We are doing on stage what Shakespeare was doing sort of thematically and textually.
By being a multiple characters.
Exactly.
And, and music. There's music in this play. What part does the music play?
Well, Shakespeare really understood how music affects an audience. And so we, like in Shakespeare's time, the actors and the audience are experiencing the same music in the same way, unlike in the movies where there's underscoring that tells the audience how to feel, but the actors just are not aware that it's happening. So we've set the songs that Shakespeare has in the play, and he chooses them very carefully. And we've also added lots of music to help with storytelling, to take us from place to place, to send signals about the kind of atmosphere that we're in, and to choose songs that have lyrical content that reflects the themes and ideas that are in the play.
Let's hear a little sample right now, if we can.
Is it true that I've lost you? And am I not the only one? After all,
you've done. Heart to heart, dear, how I need you, like the flowers need the dew. Loving you has been my lifeblood. I can't believe we're really through. Is it true that I've lost you? And am I not the only one? After all this pain and sorrow, darling, thank God what you've done.
That, of course, written by Will Shakespeare and the Thames Mountain Boys. Tell us what part that plays in the play.
Well, you know, the Shakespeare takes us from the court of Cymbeline out into the country in Wales, where we meet what we've been calling the rustics, but we meet Bellaria and her two sons, and so what we thought was maybe we could find a way, and in the play they sing and they play instruments, and so we thought, well, maybe we could find a way to make them a kind of family band that would kind of play in the style of Appalachian music, and as a way we could show the audience both kind of that we've left an urban environment and have gone into a sort of wild one, a rural one, but also that they love each other and that part of how they express their love is through music. And so when we introduce these characters to the audience, their morning ritual begins with this music. But even here, the song is about, is it true that I've lost you? You know, it's about betrayal. Mm-hmm. And
truth and belief and perception.
And perception. Is it true? I mean, it's a question, mm-hmm. which is key to the end of this play, that people are asking the right questions when it's all over. And the idea of using music as a verb rather than an adjective or worse, a punctuation point, mm-hmm. I think is wonderful. And it's a great idea to sort of advance the plot with the music rather than make the whole thing stop. So have you seen great productions of Cymbeline in your life? Can you describe what makes a great production that you've seen?
I saw the Globe production with Mark Rylance. Must be 10 or 12 years ago now when I was studying in London in college. And I don't remember all that much about the production. I remember Mark Rylance's performance, and he doubled as Posthumus and Cloten. It was also a small cast. I think it was 8 or 10 people, but their doubling was different math than ours. But I remember sort of being taken away with the sweeping epicness of the story and being really pulled in by the performances and loving some of the text. So I think that was why I was excited to work on this text, but I don't remember how they sort of approached the ending. Which
it's interesting to think about
challenge.
Posthumus and Cloten being played by the same. Cloten is the dopey son of the queen who you were asked not to like right from the very start. This guy is not even worth telling you the story. He's so bad. And of course, Posthumus, the hero, and he's described in very heroic terms. Posthumus, on the other hand, believes the false report of his wife's infidelity and then becomes a pretty rotten guy. So the guy who starts out good gets kind of bad. The guy who starts out bad takes his body. In a way, Shakespeare, this wasn't just a as you say, a simple plot device, a funny way to substitute one for the other. Cloten without a head, Posthumus without a head is the guy he's become. He's literally lost his head.
Mind, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's lost his mind. So all of these devices work pretty well. But what about bad productions? You know, the mistake that directors make in staging this.
Well, you know, we think of ourselves as part of the larger theater community, so we never want to cast aspersions on other people's work.
But name them.
But no, I mean, I've seen a production that was unsuccessful, and people in the production told me that they felt it was unsuccessful. There was on a huge kind of operatic scale, so there were tons of people, and they tried to do every event in a fairly literal way, and they also the audience kind of isn't sure whether or not they're supposed to take that seriously. You know, it's kind of trying to be cinematic, but it can't, so that was one kind of mistake, I think. And the other orientation that was perhaps not useful was really treating the play dead serious. Not kind of leaving room for it to be absurd or to let each moment be what it is, but kind of saying this is about serious stuff. And
missing the comedy in Shakespeare's bit. The worst productions of Hamlet are the ones that assume that he's just a sad guy all the way through. And, man, it just goes nowhere. Starts out sad, gets worse, and there's no movement.
Yeah,
no,
Shakespeare just doesn't do that.
Yeah, and Shakespeare doesn't do that, and life doesn't do that.
Right.
We often laugh in our darkest moments. You know, or find a kind of gallows humor, and I think Shakespeare understands that it's more representative of life when comedy and tragedy exist together. It also allows the audience to have a kind of emotional swing. in a way that lets you process the story and the information better. Because if you, you know, if you sort of start off with a, you know, a baleful tone and you just sort of march inexorably toward deep tragedy, there you just never let the pressure off, and it actually stops having an effect at a certain point, and the audience can no longer process it. So it both doesn't represent life well, and it actually isn't good theater. Yeah. when you try to make every event one sort of have one tone.
So what are we to make of this bombastic appearance of Jupiter at the end? I mean, is it
if you're fiasco theater, nothing.
what do we do with that?
Well, we go ahead, Jesse.
Well, we cut the event of Jupiter descending from the heavens on a golden eagle.
That's like taking the helicopter out of Miss Saigon, by the way, you could do that.
when we first staged this, we did it on what's called a showcase contract in New York. We had very, very little money. We did it in a raw. An old loft space. So we didn't have a fly system. We didn't have a backstage. We could have made Jupiter happen somehow, but we felt that it wasn't necessary to our production. It's not actually necessary for the plot in Act 5 to move forward. And so we tried our first version of a cutting without it. And what we found is that it worked. It completely worked because it wasn't necessary for the plot. But after we finished reading that first cutting, it didn't feel like the play had a thematic ending. And so we went back and looked at that scene and realized that we needed some of the thematic content that Jupiter says.
So what is the theme? Why did Shakespeare put it in? Because, again, you can imagine Shakespeare sort of, given some of the satire he wrote about other theater and other poetry, you guess this is the last thing he wants in any of his plays in some ways. I don't know. I may be wrong about that, but you can almost hear the machinery creaking in the background and think, mm-hmm. Is he making a joke about the overdone sort of overmuch waving of the hands?
It's possible.
But what is the point? What are those thematic elements that you think were important? Why did he write it in?
Well, the thing that resonated with us is that he says, be not with mortal accidents oppressed. No care of yours it is the gods. Whom best they love, they cross to make their gift the more delayed, delighted. So this is, it, for us, that resonated with this idea of not knowing where you are in your own story and of processing suffering and confusion and grief and kind of existential crises as a path towards greater understanding and the possibility of joy.
So whether you're a deist or not, the idea of providence, something beyond our control and our complete understanding, is at work here. Again, whether you're a deist or not.
Exactly. I mean, why that event is in Cymbeline, I'm sure there are multiple interpretations for. Part of what's happening there, I think, is that Shakespeare is spending a lot of time to rehabilitate the character of Posthumus. So we're just spending time with him. And part of it is, you know, in a play that otherwise, as we've said, that otherwise seems to say that things happen, and things that seem like highs are lows, and things that seem like lows are your way up to a high. But that, you know, when with this descent of Jupiter, all of a sudden, at least to our ears and eyes, he inserts this idea that don't worry, someone is above you pulling the strings. Perhaps it's a sop to a monarch, you know, in a living at a time and in a country in which those ideas were very important. We have someone above us taking care of us. But it doesn't actually, as Jesse said, move the plot forward.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Sounds like a delightful show. Jesse, Noah, and Ben, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jesse Austrian, Noah Brody, and Ben Steinfeld are the co-artistic directors and co-founders of Fiasco Theater Company. Their production of Shakespeare's Cymbeline is on stage now at Duke Performances. You can see it tonight and tomorrow. Tickets go to dukeperformances.duke.edu. Coming up after a short break, Sea Cow coming back. They've got a new album out. They will be here on the State of Things before their appearance at the Cave. Stay tuned.